geopolitical tensions are flaring up again, specifically, you know, the escalating confrontation between the U.S. and Venezuela.
Right.
And when we see headlines about this, security maneuvers, sanctions, we tend to frame it in these very big global terms, a foreign policy crisis happening somewhere far away.
But the material we're digging into today, it just flips that script. It demands a much deeper and, frankly, a far more urgent look.
How so?
Well, this deep dive is based on a major white paper written from a Caribbean perspective. And for them, for the small island states, these tensions aren't abstract at all. They're an existential threat.
Wow.
Yeah. The confrontation is being viewed not just as a political fight, but as a crucial, ongoing test of civilizational maturity.
Civilizational maturity.
Yeah.
That phrase alone is incredibly powerful. So they're saying the problem isn't just what is happening,
but how it keeps happening.
Oh,
exactly.
Yeah.
This document reframes these confrontation cycles, like the one we're seeing now, as this predictable, recurring historical pattern.
And it's driven less by what, rational interests?
Less by rational interests and more by these deep-seated psycho-historical dynamics.
Okay, so our mission today is pretty clear then. First, we need to diagnose those deeper patterns, the psychology behind the escalation.
Right. Second, we have to assess the immediate, very real, and often devastating regional impact on the Caribbean states.
And finally, we'll get to the proposed solution, something they call the Regenerative Security Framework.
Yep. And it's so important to stress that the Caribbean viewpoint here, it's not peripheral. These nations aren't just observers.
They're the immediate shock absorbers for the conflict.
That's the perfect way to put it. The human, the economic, the ecological fallout of these great power conflicts, it's felt immediately in their homes, in their economies.
Which makes their call for a different approach.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just theoretical, it's urgent and moral.
It's the difference between analyzing a storm from a safe building and writing about it from the eye of the storm. They are demanding a security architecture that actually reflects their reality.
Okay, let's start with that diagnosis then. The source material does this stunning analysis of what it calls the predictable arc of U.S. intervention in Latin America.
Oh, the last century, yeah.
And it's laid out almost like a five-step roadmap of escalation.
Yeah.
It is chilling how repetitive it is.
The consistency is startling.
Nah.
So step one, it always starts with a moral framing. A foreign government is cast as an illegitimate, grave threat to stability or democracy.
So it's not just a disagreement, it's an existential designation.
Exactly. Then step two, that moral frame is used to validate economic coercion. That's when we see the sanctions start to escalate.
And we know from history that sanctions rarely just stay as sanctions.
Precisely. Which leads to step three, diplomatic isolation. The country is systematically cut off from regional and international bodies.
Okay.
Step four is the shift toward a security framing. The use of force goes from being, you know, unthinkable to being on the table as a necessary, maybe regrettable option.
And the final slide.
Step five. Military intervention is presented as the only and often the unavoidable choice left to contain the so-called threat.
To give this some real weight, the source points to a devastating list of examples that follow this exact sequence.
Across totally different eras, too.
Right. You've got the overthrow in Guatemala in 54, the long, grinding campaign against Cuba since the 60s.
The coup against Allende in Chile in 1973.
Yeah.
The conflicts in Nicaragua in the 80s.
And the invasion of Panama in 89. I mean, the list goes on.
And what's so striking is that the ideology of those governments, socialists, communists, nationalists, whatever, it differed wildly.
But the playbook used against them.
The emotional and structural logic deployed by the intervening power remained remarkably consistent. It really suggests the conflict is driven by something much deeper than just a policy disagreement.
Okay, so we have to talk about that deeper driver. The paper argues the real engine here is what it calls the underlying civilizational operating system. And this isn't about any one administration's policy. It's about the inherited assumptions that just accelerate escalation when things get stressful. What are those core components?
They highlight four critical ones. The first is moral exceptionalism. This is the deep-seated belief that, you know, our power is inherently different.
Meaning when we intervene, it's for a good reason, even if the actions are identical to things we condemn in others.
Exactly. The second is the sacralization of national identity, which makes any challenge to state power feel like a personal, almost religious attack.
And that leads right into the psychology of it all, doesn't it? Especially unprocessed trauma.
Yes. The third and fourth components are really tied together. Unprocessed historical trauma, and what they call binary moral cognition under fear.
Okay, break that down. How does that work on a national scale?
Well, think about an individual who has experienced severe trauma. They might live in a state of hypervigilance. Every little ambiguity is read as a major threat.
So they inflate threats, they have zero tolerance for uncertainty.
And they feel this constant compulsion toward preemptive control to avoid getting hurt again.
And you apply that to a nation, and it becomes this permanent security posture operating outside of normal international rules.
You've got it. When fear is embedded that deeply in a nation's identity, force becomes the default way to regulate uncertainty. The paper argues this isn't just real politic or cruelty, but a dysregulated historical memory combined with enormous coercive power.
Which creates that binary moral cognition. You're either with us or you're a threat. There's no middle ground.
No room for neutrality, no room for complex non-alignment.
That concept, that compulsion toward preemptive control, is the perfect bridge to the main weapon in this arc.
Right.
Sanctions.
Right.
We're so conditioned to see sanctions as, you know, nonviolent pressure, a diplomatic tool that's short of actual war.
And the source material just fundamentally challenges that entire frame.
Uh-huh.
They argue that broad, long-term sanctions, they are not nonviolent.
They call them something else.
They call them a form of slow kinetic warfare or dispersed structural violence.
That is a highly charged term. Slow kinetic warfare. Why use language that loaded?
To force us to focus on the outcome, not the mechanism, kinetic implies a real impact on living things. And they argue that while there are no bombs going off, the physiological and systemic burden on civilians is undeniable.
So the structural violence is the mechanism.
It's the currency collapse, the chronic shortages of food and medicine, the degradation of infrastructure, the fact that a doctor's salary is suddenly worthless.
It's bureaucratized suffering. The violence is handed down in memos and banking regulations, not dropped from a plane, which makes it easier for policymakers to rationalize the human cost.
Precisely. And here's the counterintuitive twist they really emphasize. This kind of violence constrains civilian survival while often leaving the political elites relatively insulated.
How so?
Well, the elites often have other ways to get currency, resources, healthcare outside the public system that has collapsed. The general population is trapped inside it.
And that structural violence, it doesn't just stop at the border. Let's dig into section 5 of the paper on the immediate consequences for the Caribbean states.
Yeah, they're the first to absorb the spillover.
And the impact is, what, multi-layered?
Oh, it's multi-layered and immediate. Just take the energy sector. These nations immediately face energy insecurity, wild fuel price volatility.
Which then ripples through everything. Transportation, electricity, the cost of food.
Every single imported good. And since they are maritime economies, they are totally exposed to disruptions in vital trade corridors.
Beyond trade, there's the social shock.
Absolutely. A huge influx of migrant and refugee populations, which puts immense strain on already fragile health and social systems. You see tourism become volatile because who wants to vacation next to a region in crisis?
And what about the financial side? That's often overlooked.
It is, but it's huge. Caribbean financial sectors have massive exposure to complex U.S. and EU sanctions regimes. This leads to banks de-risking, which basically means cutting them off from the global financial system.
So it all reinforces this core structural problem.
It does. Their economies are narrow. They rely on imports. They're highly climate vulnerable. So even a minor destabilization next door just cascades through their entire system.
They call the region. What was the phrase?
Structurally allergic to militarized escalation. They absorb the casualties of great power conflict first and longest, even when they have nothing to do with it.
This overwhelming vulnerability, Justin, it makes the need for a different kind of solution absolutely essential. So let's pivot from the critique to the main contribution here, the regenerative security framework.
Right. And this requires a really radical redefinition of what security even means.
It's not about domination.
Not at all. They define security not as domination or just piling up coercive power, which they say is inherently unstable, but as coherence. Coherence across social, economic, ecological, and historical systems.
It's grounded in system science. Stability is only achieved by integrating complexity and trauma, not by trying to suppress it.
Which is the cycle of reproduction we've been talking about.
So security becomes a state of systemic harmony, not just the absence of war. This framework rests on four pillars of coherence. Let's walk through them.
The first is legal coherence. This is all about predictable, universally applied international law, clear sovereignty norms, and due process that intentionally restrain that moral exceptionalism we talked about.
So the big powers have to be willing to play by the same rules they impose on others.
That's the only way to build trust. Second is economic coherence. This focuses on intense cooperation in shared resources, trade, energy, infrastructure to stabilize people's livelihoods.
The idea being, if our economies are deeply intertwined, the cost of conflict becomes too high for anyone.
It becomes economically irrational. The third pillar is narrative coherence. Now, this is maybe the hardest one. It requires public truth-telling and historical reckoning.
This isn't just PR, I take it.
It's the polar opposite of PR. It's about the societal work needed to loosen those binary us versus them frames. It means acknowledging past harms, not to assign blame forever, but to stop the cycles from repeating.
So if the old operating system runs on myth, narrative coherence is the process of patching that system with truth.
That's a great way to put it. And finally, the fourth pillar is regional coherence. The paper is crystal clear on this. Security must emerge from shared stability, not unilateral dominance.
Meaning multilateral, regional bodies like, in the Caribbean and Latin America, have to be the primary architects of their own security.
They have to be in the driver's seat.
Okay, let's make this concrete.
Yeah.
Applying this to the U.S.-Venezuela crisis right now, what does a coherence-oriented approach actually look like in terms of policy?
The paper lists several immediate specific shifts. First and foremost, an immediate recommitment to regional mediation frameworks, using groups like CARICOM as the primary channel for dialogue.
And what about sanctions, which are the main source of that structural violence?
The priority is graduated sanctions relief. But, and this is crucial, it has to be tied to verifiable humanitarian and economic benchmarks. The relief has to directly help stabilize the civilian population, not just serve as a political bargaining chip.
Makes sense. Beyond that, there are the economic priorities for the region itself.
Yes, things like creating Caribbean Basin energy stabilization agreements to insulate the islands from press shocks, and formally protecting maritime trade corridors as essential civilian infrastructure.
So you treat them like hospitals or power grids.
Exactly. And finally, they recommend shifting how issues like corruption are handled instead of unilateral sanctions, which harm civilians.
Use joint enforcement through established international legal bodies.
Which connects right back to legal coherence. You use the rule of law, not the law of might.
In short, the entire goal is to re-anchor security policy in human resilience and the rule of law, not just adversarial dominance.
And that's the philosophical heart of it. They title the conclusion From Shadow to Integration.
The shadow being?
The repressed historical violence and trauma that drives that predictable arc. And they stress that you don't eliminate the shadow by suppressing it or denying it exists.
You integrate it.
Yes. Through historical remembrance, accountability without demonization, and exercising power without inflating a mythic identity. The paper literally calls this the difference between imperial adolescence and civilizational maturity.
A society that can regulate its own fear internally doesn't need to regulate others externally through force.
That's the core idea. And so the paper leaves us with a very stark choice. This escalating crisis is a branching point. One path is renewed coercive destabilization, which just guarantees the same old cycle.
And the other?
The other is regenerative stabilization, rooted in coherence, dignity, and lawful cooperation.
And that is a core takeaway for you, the listener. Power that isn't coherent, power driven by fear and unacknowledged history, is ultimately self-destabilizing. The view from the Caribbean shows us that integration, systemic coherence, mutual stability, not dominance, is the only foundation for a lasting peace.
And that leaves us with a final thought for you to consider this week. The paper concludes that security achieved through fear is dynamically unstable. It requires constant reinforcement at an ever-escalating cost.
Mm-hmm.
So, thinking about the conflicts and crises of the last 50 years, what specific historical action or decision best exemplifies this non-regenerative, fear-based approach? And really think about the cost of that action versus the actual lasting stability it delivered.